You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ Molawa'a, K284AL Hale'iva. It's time now for In the Garden on the Farm.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, board, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Paul and Robin, and on today's show, we'll crack open some juicy details of the lychee family, Sapindaceae, make almost everything better through lactic acid fermentation, and pucker up to an essential backyard fruit tree. Aloha, Robin.
Aloha, Paul.
How fares it?
Wonderfully.
Good, good.
Yes.
Back in the garden and on the farm today. Looking forward to spending the hour with our listeners and focusing in on some great plant-related material, hopefully some nuggets that will be useful to people in their endeavors. And let's start off by thanking the donors to the membership drive we held a couple weeks ago. We had some great support, and we want to give thanks by name to some of our donors. Son and Jay, Steve, Shaka, Jessica, Marin, Harvest, and Jim, and David, thank you so much for your contributions. We feel really supported by you, and thank you for voting us back in as your gardening spokespeople here on Kauai Community Radio.
Big mahalos.
So yeah, we're proud to be amongst an amazing group of plant-centric people, plant-minded people. We certainly are wanting to serve you in the best way we can, and we do that in great partnership with KKCR Kauai Community Radio. So we're super stoked. We've got a good show for you today, and we're going to start as we do with our celestial session, where we look to the heavens above for guidance on our planting, harvesting, and other gardening activities. And we'll start as we do with the moon phase of the day. And this is the Hawaiian moon phase brought to us by the 2014 Hanalei Moon and Tide Calendar, which is a Hanalei Watershed Hui publication. As well, we want to thank the Astronomical Applications Department of the U.S. Naval Observatory for providing precise times for us, and many people access their precise information for their own calendars. Today's Hawaiian moon phase is Akua. And Akua is in the poipoi, or fullness, Anahulu, the second week in the Hawaiian moon month. And Akua will rise here on Kauai at 5:25 p.m. this afternoon. She'll reach her transit, or highest point in the sky, at 11:58 p.m. tonight. And she will set at 6:33 a.m. tomorrow morning. 99% of the moon's beautiful face is illuminated, and full moon is tomorrow at 12:23 p.m. The mana'o for Akua means, in addition to the 14th night of the moon. In addition to that, Akua means god, goddess, spirit, a ghost, a devil, image, idol, a corpse, divine, supernatural, and godly. And it is one of the first, it is the first of three full moon phases, followed by Hoku and Mahialani. And it is said that all things reproduce abundantly. And it is also a good day for fishing. So today, the specific planting recommendations from the traditional Hawaiian system: kalo, taro, uala, sweet potato, and mai'a, banana. In fact, Akua also is an alternate name for the Tahitian fe'i, which is a close relative of the Hawaiian bananas, but actually a different species. It's a cooking plantain like so many of the Hawaiian bananas. And I'm only guessing, but perhaps the reason that it got this name is because the fe'i has an amazing vertical fruit stalk where the ripening fruit all the way through the entire development and ripening of the fruit is held aloft rather than nodding over like a regular banana, and it resembles, can you guess?
Tell me.
It resembles a kahili, and the kahili is the the feather standard that was a symbol of Hawaiian royalty, and the ali'i were revered as if they were akua or gods. And so perhaps because of the image that this fe'i represented, it was named akua in Hawaii. Just a guess.
Incredible. I was lucky enough to have some fe'i bananas there when I was in Polynesia, and they're delicious.
Yeah. It's a wild plant there. If you go up into the deep forests, fe'i is one of the banana relatives that is seeded in its natural range, and they do naturally range in French Polynesia, so they can actually be spread by the birds and discovered as a plant. Here in Hawaii, if you encounter a banana in the wild, it was almost certainly planted at some point somewhere nearby by humans in the long past ago time, or maybe right in that spot. However, in Tahiti and other high islands in French Polynesia, if you find a clump of fe'i, it could be a bird that planted it.
Incredible. Any chance you have a banana like that growing in the food forest?
We do. We have a couple of, we think that we have a couple of two different fe'i varieties. Maybe it's the same. We need to continue to observe it when they both go into flower and take some more observations. But we believe that we have Ayuri and Afara, two Tahitian varieties of plantain. And we hope to add more as time goes on.
Incredible. Wow, what a great story. Well, in the biodynamic look at things, we're still in the ascending moon period, so the energies are rising up. And with full moon right here, we've talked about in the past how plant rootlets or root hairs tend to move up towards the full moon. Mm. So this really is an ideal time to brew up some of our compost tea and get it out there onto the soil when the plants are really ready to receive it. So that's one thought on some good activities in the next day or two. Today and tomorrow, the moon's in Aries, a fire sign, making a good time to work with our fruit plants, maybe a great time to fertilize those fruit trees. Friday through Sunday, the moon will be in Taurus, an earth sign, making it a good time to work with our root-type plants. And Monday and Tuesday next, the moon will be in Gemini, an air sign, making it a good time to work with our flowering plants, and it is at that time that the moon will begin its descending phase, and we'll get more into planting time when the energies are more heading down towards the center of the earth and our roots can dig deep.
Mm-hmm. And thanks to Maria Thun and Matthias, her son, and all the people who forward that biodynamic knowledge of planting and celestial influences. We had a great show. We got a lot of nice comments about the show we aired last week about biodynamics. And again, if people are interested in that film, and maybe you heard about it but you missed the connection, this is The Challenge of Rudolf Steiner was the name of the film, and it can be found at rudolfsteinerfilm.squarespace.com for the full 3-hour content there, so definitely worth a look.
Incredible, yeah, and don't want to forget to mention that just this past Sunday, the moon moved into Libra out of the very large constellation of Virgo, which you've heard us talk about being an extra large constellation. The sun and the moon take extra time there. Now the moon's finally entering Libra, and it will stay there for just a short 18 days until it moves into the watery sign of Scorpio. So those Libras are a little more rare than maybe we thought they were. We should appreciate them extra.
So we are going to move on to a notable news item. Robin is a smart person in that she's got a subscription to Acres magazine, which is just a font of knowledge. And for me, I just depend on her telling me all about it. So
sure, passing on my old my last month's magazines. Well, this I thought was really interesting in the October issue of Acres USA. Cover crops mean big business. And the National Wildlife Federation put out a report called The Growing Business of Cover Crops, which details new business opportunities arising from a resurgence in the ancient practice of cover cropping, which is great news for us organic farmer types. Over the last decade, many farmers started using cover crops, creating a niche market for rural entrepreneurs. And yes, we've been talking to rural entrepreneurs a lot lately, so hope you perk your ears up. It sounds like the growing business of cover crop highlights the small business opportunities created by the upsurge in the use of cover crops, including crop advisors, seed production, sales, planting, even grazing, and it looks like the payoffs are really good. That's increased by a huge percentage in just the last few years. So people out there looking to support farmers in a way that isn't just buying their produce or working on a farm and cropping like that and have a little land, I mean, raising a little cover crop seed could be a really profitable thing to do, it sounds like.
Yeah. And here in the Hawaiian Islands, people depend heavily on cover crop. We're going to be focusing in on cover crop some more on a show coming up soon. And for folks who went to the Seed and Plant Exchange last Sunday, you saw that beautiful row of sun hemp growing right up where we had the event. And just a great super crop that we have talked about on so many occasions, and one that is grown in the Hawaiian Islands on Molokai specifically as a commercial crop.
That's right. The Molokai Seed Company sends it over in priority flat rate boxes. It's really economical, and you're supporting Hawaii farmers buying Hawaii seed that's mm-hmm. already acclimated. It's kind of win-win for everybody.
And more and more of the farmers in Molokai looking to grow their own cover crop seed. And we have friends, we're hoping to do an on-farm tour sometime soon in conjunction with that. And John Wooten is using a seed, I'm trying to remember the term, but it's basically allowing the cover crop to go to seed so that he gets a second round of it as well. So lots of innovative ways to use the cover crop, and we'll be looking more into that in the future.
Absolutely. Well, that's a pretty easy way. Just let the seed drop where it is and regrow.
Get a second round.
Yeah.
So this is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. And coming up, we are going to be delving into the world of billions of microorganisms that can benefit us in our gardens and farms. Right now, we are going to have a look at one of the cherished fruit trees that could be included more and more in our cuisine, in our health, and just another example of liquid sunshine that is coming to fruition on Kauai right now.
That's right. And so when I walked out this week and looked at what's going on in my kitchen garden, I found lemons. I found Meyer lemons. Meyer lemons are just rocking out. Granted, they are workaholics. That's really what it comes down to. They really never stop producing. Once you have a healthy tree that's starting, sometimes I almost want to prune off some of the young fruits because the tree just looks like it's working so hard, putting out such an abundant crop. Lemons are botanically called Citrus limon, and there are two main varieties that we grow here in Kauai that I know of. One, of course, is the Meyer, which is actually a cross between a lemon and a grapefruit, which makes it be extra juicy, apparently, because they do have so much juice and a very thin skin, and certainly abundant. Anytime you need a little lemon juice in a recipe for a salad dressing or a little spike in your tea or just in some hot water if your tummy's not feeling good, I mean, it goes on and on. The uses for lemon. And the other variety that's commonly grown here, which I love very much as well, is the Eureka lemon. And the Eureka lemon is more like a, quote, a classic lemon. It is more like the original lemon of lemons, which, as far as I could understand, have developed in the Himalayas, is what I read, although I was under the impression that they actually originated in Italy and Europe, in the more warmer coasts of Europe there. But the Eureka is the lemon with the little point at the bottom and a much thicker rind. Mm. And when you scratch off the lemon zest of a Eureka lemon, you think, ah, that's what a lemon, that's lemon right there.
Is that sort of the standard sun-kissed lemon
yes,
that we
is.
See?
Yes, it is. I believe
style.
So. Probably some sub-variety of that that's ultra-productive.
Right.
Because the Eureka in our orchard definitely has its seasons, and I don't get as many lemons by any stretch of the imagination as a Meyer will give me. But when I'm looking for that real lemon flavor, that's where I go to. And I really like using the zest of that one in particular. It's not as juicy as the Meyer either. Well, no matter how you choose to use your lemons, they're really high in ascorbic acid, which is vitamin C. It boosts the immune system. And also citric acid, something different, which is actually a preservative, but does help smooth the digestion as well. They're high in vitamin A and beta carotene. And I wanted to give folks just a couple quick ideas, especially right now looking at other seasonal fruits. Tamarinds are kind of, they've been going pretty hard. They're starting to finish. And one of my favorite drinks to make is tamarind lemonade sweetened with a little bit of honey. They're absolutely delicious. Mm. If you soak the tamarind seeds in the lemon juice for a few hours, it does a really good job of removing them from their seeds, so you don't lose too much of that tamarind pulp.
Nice.
And then blend that up with a little bit of water and top it off to your tastes with honey. Absolutely delicious. And lemon water, gosh, lemon zest, lemon juice, plenty of ways to use it. And the other benefit about having this tree in your backyard is, A, you'll always have them, and B, you get to get them when they're perfectly ripe. Sometimes when you see them at the market, they're still a little green. They haven't completely developed. All vendors and farmers like to harvest their fruit at different times for reasons of maybe there's pressure on their farms with fruit flies and things like that. But when you've got one in the backyard, you walk by it every day, you can see when that first one drops off and that comes in the house, and the tree gets to ripen its fruit perfectly, which is why I recommend planting a lemon in your backyard.
Yeah. Well, thank you for puckering us up to that opportunity. And we are also enamored, in addition to our beautiful citrus trees, many delicious fruit trees. It's great to have a selection, not only to be producing throughout the year, but also to be producing many different qualities of edibles that we can enjoy. And there's a whole section of fruits that we are delighted in here on Kauai, economically important, as well as some really unusual ones that you only see on rare occasion, but hopefully we'll see more and more. And this is our family of the month that we're focusing in on, and it is Sapindaceae, known as the lychee family. It's also the family, according to some, that includes maple trees and is often referred to as the soapberry family.
That's right. Well, when we get started on this botanizing, as much as I love it, I like to head out a little bit outward before we go inward into the family and hit up the order. And this is in the Sapindales order, which also includes our beloved citrus, maple trees, now that they've been removed out of Sapindaceae, but they are still a very close relative. The mango and cashew types are in the Sapindales order, along with the lychees. Frankincense and myrrh, also in that family. I thought that was very interesting. And then in the order as well, mahogany and neem trees. So we've got a really diverse family here with so many economically important plants, mahogany being one of the main tropical hardwoods that people grow for lumber. Neem trees, of course, almost speak for themselves and the ancient beauty of frankincense and myrrh. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited about this month. I think we're going to have a lot of fun delving into this family.
We certainly will. And just as a window in for people who are thinking about all these relationships and how they're defined, and we'll look at different sources, resources, books, sources on the internet, and we see variations in terms of how many species, how many genera are in each family, and which orders do they belong to, and which are the close and the far relatives. And it's really all pretty subjective in a way. I mean, if you think about an analogy, might be you've got a whole bunch of things and you're trying to coordinate and organize them, and you've got 25 different boxes to put them in, and they've got all kinds of interrelated relationships. Any one person might put them into different sets of those 25 boxes. Or somebody might decide, you know, I only need 18 boxes. Or somebody might go out to get another 50 boxes to organize them in. And they really are all related, but the philosophy of how they might be grouped is up to some debate.
It's ever-changing. It's kind of a living, breathing thing, especially with the onset of molecular genetics and the ability to look into plants' genomes. I know a lot of the classifications are based originally on flowering, reproduction, and what the flowers, and if the flower structures were similar, they were lumped together in a group.
Right, and that generally is still the way that it's done, but it's the more general associations on a larger sense, like Robin was talking about the orders beyond the family size and how those relate to each other, have gotten swapped around more when we've been looking at the molecular evidence of their evolutionary ties. And so leave it to the scientists. They'll continue to revise these things. But for the time being now, we can rest assured that some of the plants that we are going to observe today certainly do have many characteristics that are shared. And when it comes down to the act of horticulture and wanting to cultivate these plants, they'll have some similar desires in terms of care, and oftentimes it will be related to the part of the plant that is used. One of the characteristic things about the Sapindaceae family is that often it is a structure called the aril that is used, and that is a fleshy structure that is formed around the seed and essentially becomes the fleshy fruit portion, but botanically it is not a true fruit. It is actually a modified piece of the connection between the seed and the stem of the seed, so the funicula or the hilium, botanically speaking. But it is a fleshy appendage and was described in one resource that I looked at is as an edible incitement for an animal to come along, eat it, and then dispose of the seed somewhere else, probably through its digestive tract. Examples would be the mace on nutmeg and two very important spices. And for people who haven't actually seen this tremendous thing, they can be grown in the Hawaiian Islands. Most people are familiar with a nutmeg, which is basically the seed of the nutmeg, but then on the outside of it is this incredible sort of pinkish red aril
network. And it's such a beautiful design, usually.
Yeah, and definitely worth scratching up a photo of that on the internet if you've not seen the mace, which is the aril on the outside of the nutmeg. I grew up with yew bushes back on the East Coast.
Yeah, me too.
And they would go into fruit in the wintertime, and it is a beautiful red aril on the outside of the seed, which you said a friend of yours had an unfortunate run-in with.
Yeah, when you're little, don't eat the berries.
Right. So one example of a fruit that's very good for birds and not good for humans. And there are examples that we'll get to here in the Sapindaceae family that we have to be careful of so that we're not poisoning ourselves as well. And so in addition, lychee would be a classic example of an aril. Lychee, belonging to the family Sapindaceae, has the edible aril, which is the juicy fruit part.
So delicious.
Yes, they are. So we're looking at Sapindaceae family has a global distribution, mostly tropical and subtropical in nature.
Interesting.
And it has other qualities that I know Robin is going to share with
us. Yeah, it does. Before we move on into some specifics, another common, not every single plant in the family, but they are lactiferous. I just wanted to throw out that groovy botanical word to everyone because I like the way it sounds, frankly. But that's basically a latex-containing milky sap that's sticky. We all know it. We've all gotten it from lychees, longans, other trees related to these as well.
Mm-hmm. And so many different variations as well. Again, we look generally at the fruit structure. We look at the flower structures to define a group of plants and their relatedness. And then so many other things about their qualities can vary so greatly. So within this family, it rates between trees that can be 120 feet tall, herbaceous climbers, woody vines often, and rarely they can even be rhizomaceous herbs, as an example of one or two species in Australia, a place where plants will often exhibit extremely modified qualities to the parent plant. Australia being such an extreme environment or set of environments where a plant that arrived really needed to modify itself.
In order to stay there.
In order to survive. And that's why we have so many of the endemic plants here that are so different, is because wherever they came from, they needed to go through some pretty big changes to survive in the Hawaiian Islands.
Yeah, I was actually just going to ask you, do we have any native species?
We do,
of
indeed.
This family?
Five native species in the Hawaiian Islands, three on Kauai, one of them an extremely rare tree, Electrion macrococcus, subspecies macrococcus. This is the Mahoe tree, and a tree that is critically endangered, mostly due to insect attack. It's one of the trees that really invites the twig borer that comes in and basically drills a hole in the smaller branches, smaller to middle-sized branches, and everything away from the tree, away from the trunk of the tree on that stem will die. And die back,
gosh.
And eventually the tree is so depleted from not being able to photosynthesize probably that it perishes. And this is the time right now where the trees of the Mahoe are just getting snuffed out. I was fortunate enough to be able to visit a few and do some seed collection with the famed plant collector Ken Wood about 12 years ago up in Kokee, but the trees even then were really under a lot of pressure. And unfortunately, sometimes when we have these rare trees, it's not just a matter of, okay, we'll grow them in our landscapes and at least they'll survive there. A tree like the Mahoe in this Sapindaceae family would also receive a similar pressure from twig borers just in our backyard, and we would have an extremely hard time growing it to a healthy state, but still should be tried, of course. So in addition to that, we have a couple of more common members of the family here on Kauai. One of them, referred to as Lonomea, is the native soapberry that is here on Kauai, and it is actually, people might be familiar with Lonomea Camp down in Waimea.
I knew that sounded familiar.
And it's named for the tree, and they're actually locally common in that area. Nice, tall, hardwood tree with simple leaves and plenteous fruit you can find on the ground. I'm remembering it was back in maybe October or something that I saw fruit on the ground. The seeds are often used for lei, traditionally used for lei at least, I should say. And a soap can be derived from the fruit. I found as I was cleaning the fruits that the wash water became extremely soapy, however kind of had a strange kind of odor, so not really sure I'd want to wash my clothes in that, but
you'd need some avapui to scent it up a little nicer.
Yes, and there is a good idea actually. So in addition, there is another member of that genus in the Hawaiian Islands, and it is the more common soap berry, Sapindus saponaria, that is indigenous on the island of Hawaii and then is found through many Pacific islands as well. But it is indigenous on the Hawaiian Islands, whereas our native Lonomea soapberry tree is endemic to Kauai and the island of Oahu. And then our third native plant, more common still, the A'ali'i.
Oh.
Dodonea viscosa, a very important plant in terms of being a keystone plant in dry, harsh environments. You'll find it a lot in the Waimea Canyon area and many dry parts of the island. Beautiful papery capsules on this, very unlike the aryl-coated fruits that we find in our edible species of Sapindaceae. Indigenous to tropics and subtropics worldwide, the A'ali'i, so not just a native plant here, but of other areas, and would be interesting to see how it's used in other places as well. But a great landscape plant, and no doubt A'ali'i was distributed at the Arbor Day last Sunday. It's a very popular plant, and They're long-lived. They make a beautiful firewood in time. It's got a real twisty, heavy-grained wood.
Yeah, it's got a great shape and form as far as plants go.
Rough bark. And they are often come, it is often dioecious, so separate male and female plants, but monoecious plants are possible, so you can have both the papery capsules and the male flowers on some plants, which would be a special thing to have if you could only have one or two plants in your yard.
Of course, and that's similar to some of the other members of that family.
Right. So those are the natives. We could also look at some of the other plants that are just a general overview of plants found in the Hawaiian Islands that we know of. 5 naturalized species in Hawaii and 1 on Kauai. And then as far as cultivated plants, we do use the resource of the Bishop Museum cultivated checklist of cultivated plants, which is an online resource. It hasn't been updated in about 10 years, actually, so it maybe doesn't include everything, but it's a pretty mighty fine, well-researched snapshot, at least for 10 years ago. And at that time, 30 cultivated genera and 54 cultivated species recorded in Hawaii, that out of 146 genera and almost 2,000 species that belong to the family, according to the World Plants Database. So while we have a nice collection here in Hawaii, there's so many more that we could have a look at, and hopefully from a food perspective, we could be discovering more of the edible varieties to include as well.
No doubt. And I'd like to talk about some of the notable tropical fruits in that family that we grow here. In just a minute, you're listening to In the Garden on the Farm on KKCR. Thanks for tuning in. So we're going to talk about some notable tropical fruits here in the Hawaiian Islands, and not so seasonal right now at this time of year, but certainly one of our favorite early summer to midsummer treats is the lychee. Lychee chinensis, mostly the kind that we grow here. And gosh.
What can we say? I was excited to read that it's been cultivated in China and Vietnam for over 2,000 years. So it's hard for them to say where it came from because it's been associated with humans for so long.
Yeah, really fantastic. It's a heavy feeder, an extremely large tree. Varieties that are real common around here are the Kaimana, is one we see at the market a lot, and also Groff. And Groff, I'm sure some of the listeners out there have heard about the chicken tongue lychee. And the chicken tongue condition is when the seed actually decides to abort and shrivel. And Groff has a large percentage of chicken tongue fruits. And they usually fetch a little more money because there's more fruit and less seed there.
Yeah.
So definitely if you've got some land and you're considering an orchard, which I hope that you might, one of those two varieties might be your best choice.
Mm-hmm. Yes, lychee, the beautiful arrow, edible, and there are some very similar fruits. And this is a great way where sometimes even people who don't look at the botanicalness of plants and read into the scientific things can look at a lychee and a longan and say, these are so similar. I wonder if these are related to each other.
And indeed they are. That's the next plant I'd like to talk about, the longan, Democarpus longan. It's a self-fertile tree. There's little pruning needed, although one of the things the tree doesn't like is high winds and too much drought. They definitely are a tropical jungle tree. They like humidity. Although I've found them to be extremely tolerant, they certainly do take pruning quite well. Doesn't seem to slow them down in any way, shape, or form. And we take it upon ourselves to keep our longans kind of low so that it's not quite so hard to harvest the fruit. Another trick that people use with this whole family, but I've done it and seen its effects on longans, is when the flower rack does come out and it's pretty big and there's lots of flowers. And what's typically done by commercial growers is the top third of that flowering rack is clipped off. So the flowers and they're then fruits that will be on the on that rack are larger. If you allow the entire rack to go into fruit, you'll get a lot of long gowns, but they'll be quite small, and usually the arils quite small as well. Mm-hmm. If you clip off a third of it, you get a smaller rack, but much higher quality long gown.
And hey, we're all for fresh fruit on this show, but one great dried fruit is the long gown. I mean, it really brings out that honey sweet flavor. It's tremendous, and they're going off right now on Kauai. If you can get a whole quantity of them and then put them in the dehydrator, you will not be disappointed.
It's true. They're delicious. And again, if you're considering planting some of these species, varieties here that are well known and fruit really well are Kohala, the Sri Champu, which I always thought was a pretty cool variety name for a plant, clearly from Thailand, and also Bai Dum. That's another Southeast Asian variety that's commonly grown here. Excellent, excellent, delicious fruits.
Yeah. And a third most common plant, or fruit tree, I should say, that is familiar to the farmers markets here, maybe you're lucky enough to have one or more, would be the rambutan.
That's right.
Can you help us out with some info on that one?
I would love to. Those will just be coming into season here, so this is a fruit that you can start looking for in the farmers markets now. Nephelium lapiceum. It is native to Indonesia. And rambutan trees, like the a'ali'i, I was thinking about it when you brought up the a'ali'i being a dioecious plant, which basically means male trees and female trees are separate, and the one tree doesn't usually contain both kinds of flowers. The rambutans have males, they have females, so males have no fruit at all. Females will have fruit only when a male is present, but there are also hermaphroditic varieties of the rambutan. It makes both kinds of flowers, hence it's self-pollinating, and you will get fruits from just a single tree. Mm-hmm. And sadly, variety names here are not so interesting. R134 and R162 are the best-selling and best-known of the rambutan hermaphroditic varieties here on Kauai.
But stay away from that R175. Oh, I don't like that one at all.
Yeah. Well,
just kidding.
Hard to say. There are lots of variety names in Indonesian, but again, climates there, climates here, not quite exactly the same. And that brings me to an interesting fruit that I just learned about called the pulasan. And the pulasan is a rambutan, very close to rambutan, mm-hmm. except the little hairs, for lack of a better term, on the fruits are shorter, they're stubbier. Mm-hmm. Although there are some growing here in the Hawaiian Islands, it is an ultra-tropical tree. So not something you're going to find at latitudes straying too far from the equator.
Right. So not proven as a successful tree here in the Hawaiian Islands as far as we know.
That's right.
But people are experimenting with it, and its affinity with rambutan is revealed by its botanical name, Nephilium, the same genus, and then rambutan ake is the species name. So definitely worth looking more into, and from what I read as well, similar to rambutan, separate male and female plants except for some hermaphrodites, and so the recommendation was to get an air layer of a hermaphroditic plant so that you can ensure that you will have fruit production.
Indeed. And, you know, I was misled several years ago but I was told that rambutan seeds were edible and that they taste like almonds and they're delicious. And so I'd made a habit of, you know, munching down on them whenever I would eat a rambutan fruit, thinking, how cool is this? You know, I mean, not that I have anything against planting the seeds, of course, but I did read recently that rambutan seeds are toxic. So not something you probably want to eat too many of.
Yes.
And there's one last member in this family that I think that segues into quite nicely. And some of you out there listening may have heard of the aki. The aki fruit is like the national tree of Jamaica or something like that.
Although originally from Africa.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Blaihia sapida. And for those of you out there who like to take a little risk when you're eating your meal and eat something that may have sort of toxic properties, I think of people at sushi restaurants ordering the puffer fish. You know, it's kind of like rolling the dice. Is this going to kill me or not? And so I read a little bit more into aki, and what I understood is that most of the time those fruits are, those arils are cooked. Although the most important part, if you do choose to consume this tree, is that it be fully ripened.
Yes.
Because it is when the fruit is in a not completely ripened state that it has quite toxic properties.
That's right. And it's also the seed that is toxic even when the fruit is ripe. And once you get to know the plant, my understanding is quite easy to tell when a fruit is ripe because it is a capsule that pops open. Mm-hmm. So it's when people actually try to get in there early, or maybe if you could imagine some environmental condition caused a fruit to be opened before full maturity, like maybe a bird bit on it or something and then it fell to the ground or something like that. So definitely one of those plants where you want to learn from somebody else who uses it. That said, with all those precautionary measures in place, one of the most beloved fruit trees for people who do grow them, but definitely recommended not to grow in areas where children or dogs or other pets might be able to access these fruits and potentially be poisoned. And I can't imagine a place where children or pets couldn't potentially be going by, so I'm not really sure where I would plant one, but beautiful trees as well. And just to finish off our investigation into the Sapindaceae family, we're going to look at a few other plants that are here in the Hawaiian Islands, starting off with the balloon vine, which has the Hawaiian name of Poniu and received a Hawaiian name because it has been present in the Hawaiian Islands since at least the early 1800s, Cardiospermum halicacabum, native to tropical America. Traditionally in Hawaii, a lei was worn on the head and then thrown into the ocean to cure a headache. So apparently believed that it had a medicinal property to soak up the headache, and then you could cast it away from your body. In other places in the world, it's eaten as a vegetable. The only member of the family where I saw that the leaves were actually edible, and many parts used medicinally as well, of the balloon vine, still found in some gardens around Hawaii. The vines are always an interesting component to our landscape, and so it's always fun to look at some of the vining plants that maybe stray outside Fabaceae or our familiar Lilikoi, and we look at some other vines that we can incorporate. It's pretty cool. And then there's a number of ornamental plants that are grown in Hawaii, common plants in Honolulu and other places. The fern tree, Phyllicum decipiens, I gather is popular in Oahu, particularly as a street tree, but
when you said that, that's exactly what I thought of, that street tree.
Yep. And however, it's thought to be allergic to some people, it has staining fruit, and it's naturalizing.
Well, too. There's a change of plant that's allergic to people.
No, it's the other way around. It causes allergies. Thank you. So at any rate, its use is discouraged. There are some other ones that are recommended. A couple would be the tulip wood tree, Harpulia pendula from Australia, another great street tree, and the golden rain tree, Coelroteria elegans from Taiwan and Fiji, which is a really interesting distribution for plants to be native to places as far-flung and, you know, only to those places, Taiwan and Fiji. It would be interesting to be able to go back through the hundreds of thousands and millions of years and learn how that dispersal event happened. But these recommended street trees, and often recommended because hopefully they don't cast dangerous or staining or other kind of fruits. They probably flower, but one of the other really important things about a good street tree is one that has a non-invasive root system that isn't going to be cracking up the pavement and the tarmac and all that kind of thing. So potentially good landscaping trees even for us that don't want invasive root systems in our gardens too. that to round out our investigation of the family Sapindaceae, we will be following up with some good growing and pest problem solve, focusing in on some of the edible fruit trees that we've discussed. And we'll be looking forward to do that on our next upcoming shows. We hope you tune in with us each and every Wednesday from noon to one. For In the Garden on the Farm, we want to encourage folks to stay tuned today for Kauai Vibrations with Tracy coming up at 1 o'clock. And we've got Shaka Kayaka and the Papule Show from 3 to 5, followed by additional great programming here on Kauai Community Radio. And we're going to finish out today's show with Secrets of the Soil Builders and our investigation on a wonderful serum that makes almost everything better in life. And that is lactic acid fermentate, or lactic acid bacteria, popularly referred to as LAB.
LAB, and something I've been so fond of for some years now. And I'm so excited, Paul, that you recently are getting more into natural farming. And I do hope that we will share our insights and our experiments and our results with our listeners as we both continue to experiment with some of these awesome natural farming techniques. LAB being just probably one of the most famous aspects of natural farming. I think it might be what got natural farming famous in China when the Olympics were going to be held there in Beijing. They cleaned up the city basically using LAB, and it was so effective that they decided to build a university, a natural farming university in Beijing.
Wow.
Just based around the results they found by using LAB. So I just want to run down a little bit of what LAB is good for, and then we'll give you some directions on how to make some at home. So LAB are very effective for improving soil ventilation. They are conditionally anaerobic, but they can, so that means they can survive with some oxygen. So they're perfect. They're somewhere in between aerobic and anaerobic.
One way I heard it described was microaerophilic, which means they just need tiny amounts of oxygen to survive. So what would generally be considered anaerobic conditions, but there's always a little bit maybe.
Yeah, not quite. That's a nice way to say it. They're strong sterilizers. They're resistant to high temperatures. LAB will accelerate root growth during transplanting and effectively enhance the initial growth of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
We love that. LAB will increase the solubility of the fertilizer. In other words, will help make the fertilizer more available. A lot of times, and I'm just starting to understand this, I was talking to our good buddy Joseph Dunsmore more and more about fertilizers, and some fertilizers are not in an available state when we lay them down, and they need to be worked on to get into an available state for the plant to use. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm still not quite clear on that process that I could explain it, but I do know that LAB helps with that process a lot. So great thing to add into that compost tea if you're considering brewing it up like we were talking about earlier. LAB is used during the vegetative growth period of fruiting vegetables, and higher quality plants will result and may be kept for longer periods in storage. So we're talking about an all-around vigor for this plant. Amazing, LAB.
The increased vigor is thought to promote pest and disease resistance as well. As we have learned, healthy plants resist or don't attract these problems. And so adding them to a soil drench, foliar feeding it, is going to increase the vigor of the plant, and it's going to make it more resistant to these problems.
Which, of course, makes the produce keep better in the long term.
That's right. And LAB is so important to so many things in life, to a healthy body as well. It is the source of sourdough bread and the cultures in yogurt, cheeses, sour cream, sausage, kimchi, olives, sauerkraut. So many of the fermented foods that we know that are good for our digestion and promote our health also promote the health of plants as well. And lactic acid bacteria is actually a huge quantity. I thought it was just acidophilus cultures, but there's many other genera of bacteria, lactobacilli, in addition to lactobacillus, including lunastococcus, enterococcus, and even streptococcus, a genus that includes flesh-eating bacteria and the source of strep throat, pink eye, and bacterial pneumonia, as some of the negative lactic acid bacteria, even streptococcus has beneficial ones that we would like to have, or even the human body has in healthy quantities. So there's good actors and bad actors. But when it comes to culturing LAB, for whatever reason, when we do the lactoacid bacteria culturing in our kitchens to get them started for use, somehow it's the beneficial ones that predominate. And fortunate for us, because it's so easy to make. And I want to thank John Parziali, as well as Ray Maquis, who held a great natural farming workshop a few months ago and got some of us started on that. So we'll give just a quick description of how that's done.
Sure. Before we move on to that, there's just one other note, and I'm wanting everyone to know that I'm reading from the natural farming workbook. The natural farming book, called Natural Farming by Cho Global, Natural Farming, has a smaller book that's a workbook that has just the basics and the recipes. And I've had such a good time reading this book, and that's what I'm sharing with you right now. But what I thought was interesting is we're heading into the rainy season here. LAB can adjust the fluids within the plant, which may increase disease tolerance or, importantly, harden their bodies even during the rainy season. So we know what happens when plants get overwatered. They get soft. Everything gets soft. The ground gets soft. We get soft. Right. It kind of just gets mushy. And LAB can give the cell walls a little more structure during this rainy period, so it is a good time to be thinking about making and using some LAB this season.
Can you share a quick recipe for us?
A quick recipe. Well, I think we can do it together if we go back and forth. Basically, the quality of the milk that you're going to start with, you usually use milk to make LAB. Mm-hmm. If you can get your hands on some raw organic milk, muy bueno, chances that you'll find a raw milk may be pretty slim. So you would go with a nice quality organic milk. A lot of the natural farming recipes do not require you to use organic inputs, but I can't see that I'd want to use anything else in this case. So getting some milk and have it in the fridge and ready, because what we do first is we wash rice. And I've done this both ways, of soaking the rice for a whole full day in the water and then using that water to culture the milk. Or people have really good success, and I did as well, by just running this water through some rice a few times and collecting it. And you let the water hang out for, it's depending on temperature, anywhere from 48 to 72 hours. Is that your experience too, Paul?
4 to 5 days is what I was taught.
Okay.
So in a container that is mostly filled with the water, so a small container where it's almost to the top, but you don't seal it. You put some sort of a cheesecloth or maybe a paint strainer bag, as we find that a popular tool, and let that's going to basically culture all kinds of things that are in the air or on the body of the rice. And then the second step is to add one part of that to 10 parts of milk, essentially. Cover that again. Now this is in a container that's about half full.
Can I interrupt? We want to warm the milk up to room temperature before we add. It just helps the culture get going.
Oh, really?
We know that putting things in the refrigerator will retard or slow down the decay process, so I find it valuable for a few hours to leave the milk out to get warm to room temperature before we add our rice wash.
Right on. So then we are allowing this to culture in a container, and this is in sort of the cool, shady part of your kitchen, essentially, or some other room in the house. After another 4 to 5 days of the 10 parts of milk to 1 part of the wash water, we're going to have a separation of the curds and the whey of the milk. And it is the whey, or the liquidy portion, that is the LAB serum. At this time of completion, where you strain off the curds or pass it through the paint strainer bag once again to get those solid materials out, you can either refrigerate that serum or you can add it 50-50 with brown sugar to stabilize it, and then you can keep that in a cool, dark place without having to refrigerate it.
That's right, and I'd like to share some of my experience when I wanted to take the serum out. There's a curd, a cheese that forms on top, but there's also some dregs that form at the bottom of the jar. Mm-hmm. And I want to caution people when they're taking the serum from the middle, you do not want to get any of the dregs from the bottom at all. You want to just get the clear syrup. So you may have to say, okay, I just can't get any more that's clear.
Right.
We want to tell you that you're only going to be using this stuff 1 part to 1,000 parts in water once it's complete. So you don't need a whole gallon of it unless you're going to cover your entire farm with it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But better to err on getting less serum that's perfectly clean than trying to squeeze out any. You definitely don't want to be squeezing it or milking it. You want a perfectly clear serum.
Mm-hmm. More information available online. Thanks again to the University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture for publishing yet another worksheet or publication on doing LAB with some nice black and white photographs of the process that we've just described to you. Have fun with your LAB in your garden or farm. We want to thank... Yes.
Also, one other website I've found so fun to watch is SQ Worms or Squirms. It's a British website, and there's every recipe you can possibly imagine making natural farming, including the LAB. There's a nice video pictorial there.
Thank you. So that's all we have time for in the show. Just a quick announcement. Seed exchange coming up this weekend at the Aloha Aina Festival at the Kekaha Boathouse. It's this Saturday, November 8th. The seed exchange will be from 11:30 to 12:30, but the whole event, 10:30 to, I believe, dark, and lots of fun events, the second annual event there. We want to thank the In the Garden on the Farm team, our engineer Jack, and sometimes engineer Dean, as well as Mac helps us with the phones, Laura Christine with the website, everybody here keeping this station running and allowing us to provide this show for you. If you want to hear archives of the show, you can go to the kkcr.org website and click the audio archive link at the top of the page. And as well, if you want your agricultural related event announced, please send it a couple of weeks in advance to inthegardenonthefarm@gmail.com.
Thank you for listening. This has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Robin and Paul. Please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha.
Aloha.